Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Showcase new authors. This is show number 98, and it is September 20th, 2021. And I am your host, Tom Riedel. A brief intro to today's show. We're going to have on author Nita DeBort, and she wrote Ghost Agents. And why not? It's almost Halloween, right? So we're going to look forward to her being on the show in about 15 minutes. Until then, you get to listen to me tell you more about us. And here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. And find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriedel.net. And that would be thomasriedel.net. And that would be in the blog section. And the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge. You can find me on Twitter at TomRiedel56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we'll get back to you. Special note, we can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to TuneIn and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. Upcoming authors on The Writer's Lounge, excited for these people. Barbara Kamick will be with us in 2 weeks with her short story, Misty Finds a Home, and her inspirational writings, Heart on Fire for God. After that, on Monday, October 18th, we'll have an author, Jeff Roberts, to talk to us about his politically charged novel, Time of Ends, an apocalyptic political polemic. And then on October 25th, a very special show for Halloween, we will have best-selling author Richard Chismar here to discuss a novel that has soared up the bestsellers list, and that novel would be Chasing the Boogeyman. So mark your calendars for all those great upcoming shows here on The Writer's Lounge. And that wraps up the show intro. And now on to Writer's Topics. On today's Writer's Topics, we will hear a great clip from Jacqueline Benson, who is an anthropologist as well as an author of historical fiction. She explores many of the topics that writers and fans of the show can relate to. Not only that, but she talks to us about a topic which is central to our show today, and that would be ghost hunters. How do you change a skeptic into a believer? From the social lives of paranormal investigators to our emotional attachments to fictional characters, author and anthropologist Jacqueline Benson explores the power that storytellers have to change the way we think and the responsibility that goes along with wielding that power in today's culture. Jacqueline Benson holds an MA in anthropology from Queen's University of Belfast, where she specialized in how cognitive shapes culture, and she wrote a thesis on the social lives of paranormal investigators. And as a disclosure to today's show, I am a paranormal investigator and have investigated several sites in the Midwest, and I am one of those people that Jacqueline Benson mentions. I was a skeptic turned believer after I began to investigate hauntings in 2010. I also am a storyteller, of course, and so I can relate to much of what Benson talks about in this clip. The central question here is, what is it that makes people change the way they think? Very interesting question, I think. And this clip is around 11 minutes long, so sit back and relax. And after the clip, we'll be back to introduce Nita DeBort.
So I want to talk to you guys today about a very important question. What is it that makes people change the way they think? So I'm a novelist with a background in anthropology, as you just heard, and I've always been fascinated by this question. Now, I think we can all agree what the answer is not, and it is not facts and rational arguments, right? Because if it was, talking about politics wouldn't make us want to crawl under our desks and hide. But profound transformations do happen. And anybody in this room who cares about social change, I think there are probably more than a few of us who do, should also care about what it is that actually makes that possible. So a few years ago, to try to better understand this, I spent several months in the field studying the social lives of paranormal investigators, ghost hunters. For those of you who aren't familiar, ghost hunters investigate reported hauntings to try and figure out first, is there a natural explanation for what's going on here? And if there isn't, then they try to collect evidence of this paranormal activity using all kinds of equipment, from electromagnetic field detectors and night vision video cameras to attacks of the goosebumps. So most ghost hunters believe in ghosts, but they don't always start out that way. So what is it about ghost hunting that has the power to turn a skeptic into a believer? The answer to that question is that ghost hunting, as it happens, taps into two of our most fundamental cognitive resources, the resources that actually do have the power to change the way we see the world. First, ghost hunting is a group activity. You don't go ghost hunting by yourself. No. Every horror movie ever teaches us that would be a terrible idea. You do this with a team, and while you are sitting there in these dark rooms for hours and hours and hours and hours waiting for something to happen, you are also building relationships with your fellow investigators. You're getting to know them and to care about them. And relationships are magic bullets for changing minds. We humans, guys, we are social animals. We are adapted to work together in groups. And part of this adaptation is that we have a reflexive, not rational, tendency for us to adjust our way of thinking about the world to be compatible with the people that we're close to or that we look up to or respect. Second, ghost hunting elicits strong emotions, right? Imagine spending your Saturday nights hanging around in a spooky abandoned insane asylum. That sounds relaxing, right? No, ghost hunting is incredibly intense and scary, and it's so much fun. Your adrenaline is running so hot that if the door creaks downstairs, you are jumping out of your skin. Now, emotion is intimately tied to how our memory works. It's like this synaptic cement, right? It just sears what would otherwise be a one-off connection into your brain and makes it stick. I'm assuming that everybody in this room right now remembers where you were on September 11th, right? Or that time that you got lost on the beach when you were a kid? Or maybe the last 3 minutes of the 2004 World Series? These experiences are burned into our brains because through each one of them, your emotions were on fire. This is why skeptics that go ghost hunting, even if they start out just trying to prove everybody wrong, rarely stay skeptical for long. This growing closeness that they form with a new tribe exerts a psychological pressure to open up the way they interpret the world, and getting scared makes that experience stick in their minds. Humans, guys, we are experts at ignoring the facts that don't agree with our existing point of view. Really good at it. But form relationships, strong relationships with people that think differently than you do, and share intense emotional experiences with them, and you might just find yourself seeing things in a whole new way. And anthropologists and psychologists, we've seen this happen with a lot more than just ghost hunting groups. It's happening with English witchcraft practitioners, Papua New Guinea cargo cults, Western environmentalists, American college students in psych labs. But what does this have to do with us and this current political climate that we're in of seemingly impenetrable opposing views? Well, if you guys want to change minds, you got to build relationships and share emotional experiences. But I'm guessing there probably aren't too many of you here who have the time or the inclination to go ghost hunting with every single climate change denier. Clearly what we need here is a way to scale this up, right? And change more than one mind at a time. And thankfully, there is a solution. Telling stories. Stories are part of humanity. We've been telling them for as long as we've been hanging around in groups. And as it happens, stories tap into exactly the same cognitive resources we've been talking about. First, stories build relationships. This is how they work. How many of you can name a character that you know as well as your best friends, right? I know that Fox Mulder never got over the disappearance of a sister, loved sunflower seeds, and would have been an absolutely awful boyfriend. Our brains don't care that these aren't real people. The relationships that we form with the characters that inhabit our favorite stories still have the power to impact the way we think, as do the emotional experiences that we share with them. Thelma and Louise sharing a kiss before they floor it over the edge of a cliff, right? Eowyn raising her sword before the king of the Nazgul telling him, I am no man. You are present in those moments, cognitively speaking. They are eliciting real emotions with all the power of that electricity to reshape the pathways of your brain. Now, obviously, not all stories accomplish this. And unfortunately, there's not an easy recipe for what makes a story not only effective in that it elicits these strong emotions and makes you care about its characters, but also viral so that it finds its way into the hands and eyes of masses. I mean, if there were, I wouldn't be giving you this talk right now because I'd be off having tea and biscuits with J.K. Rowling and Dan Brown. But each of us storytellers strives for this every time we set our fingers to a keyboard. And because we don't know which story is going to be the one to break out, we all, regardless of our medium, have a responsibility to think about the greater potential impact of what we write. Now, I'm a feminist. I know I'm not supposed to use dirty words up here, so sorry. I believe strongly in the struggle for women's rights, and I believe that that struggle that we have had so many successes is far from over. And a couple weeks ago, when I saw Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman throw off her disguise and stride out of that trench into no man's land, I fell apart. Because it's rare. It's still an anomaly to see a grown woman be the hero in a story where she isn't just fighting to survive or looking for love. I spend a lot of time hanging out in the 19th century because I write historical fiction, so I'm immersing myself in how the people of our past thought, and I can tell you that the same tropes, the same quiet old assumptions still find their way into so many of our stories today. That women are inherently more nurturing and compassionate than men, that monogamous love and a romantic relationship, presumably as a prelude to making babies, this is our true destiny, that we're less rational, that we're physically weaker and in need of a big, strong man to rescue us. But here is the thing. Every storyteller, regardless of whether you are scribbling comic books or directing blockbusters, has the power to turn disbelievers into believers, just like those ghost hunters. We have this unique ability to reach into the minds of millions, tap into their most essential cognitive resources, and open up the way they see the world. Now, as Spider-Man's Uncle Ben tells us, with great power comes great responsibility. Because we have this power, each of us creatives has a duty to think critically about the culture we reproduce in our art. Now, that is not easy. It is, in fact, deeply unsettling to question whether your ideas about gender, class, race, diversity, right and wrong, good and evil, aren't actually natural truths, but culture. And not only that, but relics of a culture that legitimized discrimination and oppression. But storytellers have many of the traits that make for great anthropologists. We're critical thinkers. We are wildly imaginative. And I honestly believe that we have this capacity not only to recognize those old tropes for what they are, but to imagine new possibilities and embody them in what we write. We can conceive of the way the world could be and move our readers and our audiences to take a step toward it. And if we succeed, if skill and talent and luck come together with the right wild ideas, then we could just change the world. Thank you.
Okay, that was a really interesting clip, I thought. And now on to the main event. Our guest author is Nita DeBort. She wrote Ghost Agents. And I want to remind you all out there, if you're listening live, you can call in. The phone number is 914-219-0868. That's area code 914-219-0868. And the book, Ghost Agents, in my review, I wrote an intriguing ghostly plot that stretches our thinking on what being dead might actually be like. Claire Ablard works as a candy store clerk on Galveston Island, off from the coast of Texas, but she does a lot more in her life than pulling taffy and filling bags of sweets for her customers. She also leads ghost tours on the island by night, but these two positions are just a cover for her real job. Claire's real job is working as an agent for the Bureau of Historical Preservation, a clandestine organization that monitors and insists energy projections, or entities more commonly known as ghosts. But there is another secret covert organization lurking around that wants to dispatch or kill these energy projections, and Claire is hoping to stop this from happening. The problem is the Bureau questions if this other nefarious organization even exists, and Claire has to try and convince them, even though some of the agents are her family. She soon learns that she's the only one who has the ability to stop the disappearances that have already claimed several of the beloved projections on the island. And I'll cut to the end of the review because I want to get on to talk with Anita here. And I just want to let everybody know that this is the first installment of a series of books for ghost agents. And this story is a keeper. It will amuse and it will also provoke history, mystery, romance, and a desire to keep reading about these wonderful and interesting characters. I love the story. And now it is my pleasure to welcome Nina DeBort to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And as we say, with a little push of the magic button, we should have her on right about now. Is that you, Nita?
That's me. Am I here? Can you hear me?
Yes. Are you on a speakerphone?
I'm on my earbud.
Okay.
Is that not good? Should I put it on my regular phone?
Yeah, I would do that because there's a little bit of an echo there.
Okay. I'll take off the earbuds then. Let me see.
And if you take it off speaker, too, if you're on speaker, it's better if you put it up to your ear.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
That's perfect.
Is that okay? Good.
So how you doing there?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Doing really good. How's the weather treating you guys down there in the south part of the United States?
Well, it's a little warm right now, but we're supposed to get a cool front later this week, and so lows in the 50s and 60s, so we're all really excited. I'm tired of 90s and higher.
Yeah, and no more hurricanes.
Yes, we hope no more hurricanes.
Right. Okay.
I'm not usually out of the woods until like late October. Late October is when we're out of the woods.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a little bit further to go here. I have to mention that this isn't your first published book, so please tell us about yourself and what inspired you to be a writer.
Well, I am a French teacher by day. That's my career. But I've always wanted to be a writer. I think when I was in, I think it was second or third grade, maybe a little later than that, I had a teacher who challenged me to write a children's story, like a short story. And we had another little girl in our class who could draw really well. And so we took our little short story, and she illustrated it, and I wrote it, and our teacher, you know, put it in a little folder. And ever since I saw people reading my story, I was hooked. And so in junior high and high school, I always had a notebook with me. I was always writing, and I wrote two novels in junior high and high school, which I haven't gone back and looked at again because I'm sure they're junior high school quality. But, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer, you know, and I just kind of got a little derailed after high school. You get into college and, you know, you don't want to read or write anything that hasn't been assigned because you have so much work. And I kind of discovered that once you turn the tap off, you know, it stays off. And so, it wasn't until about 2012 that I started coming back to writing again.
In relation to the science of what a ghost or a projection really is, which you explain in your book, mm-hmm. I've done a little research myself and found mm-hmm. that scientists agree that the human body at rest can produce mm-hmm. around 100 watts of power on average. This is enough electricity to power up a light bulb. So have you given any a lot of thought that that you might actually be onto something, what you wrote?
And well, do you believe
in ghosts?
I do believe in ghosts. I believe in a spirit realm, if that makes any sense. I don't at all believe that my story, you know, ghost agents is actual, this is what ghosts are. But I do know, you know, that I've watched enough ghost hunting and that sort of thing and other documentaries about ghost hunting and things, not just the shows where they're spectacular stuff, but like the actual documentary type shows. And it does seem like the energy plays a big part in it. You know, it affects the electronic devices. They can identify the presence of these entities through various electronic means. So I just kind of was fascinated by that idea of, you know, what really could be going on there with the electricity. So, yeah. So as the story played out, I thought, you know, I didn't want my ghost to be, you know, tormented souls or whatever. And I just thought it would be fun to have that. That there was a perception
right.
of a person's personality, you know, that so it was more like the person was stayed behind rather than just a wandering soul.
Right. Your voice sounds a little muffled. Is it
okay.
Because you're in a different area, or are you away from
the
speaker
on
the phone? Or... Okay.
I'm in my office, but I am on my phone, so I don't know why it's muffled.
Yeah.
It's
coming through pretty good, but just a little muffled at times. So have you ever been ghost hunting?
I've been on ghost tours. One of the tours was more hunter-oriented than just history. So there were people there with instruments and things like that. And so we did get a few interesting readings, but nothing really over the top. I've done a lot of ghost tours, like I said, like the more historical, where they tell you about the city and the history. But I've only been on one that was actual, like, instrument-involved, measuring things kind of tour.
Right. Yeah, the history of ghost hunting is fascinating, and it's something that when I've been out there investigating, I've always asked about the property and the history of the property that we're investigating, because it's not only interesting for what we might find when we go in there to investigate, but it's also just interesting to hear about the history of the building or maybe the people that are living in it. But I understand that you love history. Are the places in your book actually historic sites and haunted locations?
They actually are. So I've spent a lot of time down in Galveston. I do live in the Houston area. So, you know, Galveston is our beach, basically, when we want to go to the beach. And I think my family did our first historic home tour when I was in, you know, early junior high. And so my dad was a history buff, and our family just has always been into history. So, yes, I did a lot of research in Galveston about the haunted locations, and the stories are based on maybe not the names, like not all of the ghosts down in Galveston have actual names, but a lot of the characters in my story are actually, if you go on ghost tours in Galveston, they'll tell you about the school marm that pulled people out of the storm in that building, you know, during the hurricane, and they'll tell you about there is a guy at the Hotel Galvez that when you go in the bathroom, you know, he's been known to blow in women's ears and, you know, show up in selfies if they take pictures. So yeah, I tried to pull a lot of the actual ghosts that I was learning about on the tours into the book. I thought that would be fun.
Yeah, it certainly worked for me. I really, really liked it. and it had a lot of authentic, you know, feel to it. Once again, when you're out there actually doing the investigations, you know, it rings true in a lot of the things that we did. I wish we'd have more apparitions and stuff that might come up like in your book, but we did get a lot of energy spikes and all that stuff. So that was a lot of fun. So being a teacher for 20 years, how has that shaped your perspective on life, and how do you approach research as a writer and a teacher?
Well, I teach French, so it's definitely not anything that has to do with my writing. There's not a lot of connection there, except for the grammar aspect of it and just language in general. It does force me to be very intentional about when I write and when I research. You know, and I enjoy my kids get really excited when they find out I'm a writer and they want to buy a book, and I'm okay with that. I don't like push it really hard in my classroom, but I do let them know it's my side gig, basically. And I just kind of want them to know that, you know, you don't have to be pigeonholed into one thing and one job for your whole life. You know, that you can have multiple things you're passionate about, and you can do multiple things. So I think it's fun. I mean, I'm single also, so that helps. I don't have a lot of those kind of same commitments that a lot of people have in the after school hours.
Right.
So I can kind of focus myself a little bit more.
What's the average age of your students?
I teach high school, so I have a 9th through 12th grade. I have all the whole range.
Has anybody read your book, have given you any critiques on it or talked to you about it?
No, my students haven't given me any critiques other than to say, oh, Mr. Board, I read your book. I really liked it. And so, yeah, and they'll ask me things like, did that really happen? And, you know, do you think that's really what it's like? And I had one of my students tell me, you know, Ms. Ward, as I was reading your book, I kept thinking, is that really what ghosts are? You know, like the world that I created of the Bureau, she's like, you know, leaves her wondering, could that really exist? Could that really be true? And so I thought that was cool that you know, I guess I did a good enough job making it seem realistic that she was kind of wondering if maybe there is an organization out there that does that.
Yeah. There's a theory out there regarding energies, which is very mm-hmm. fascinating to me, that I listened to while I was investigating. And most of the ghosts, if there's an apparition, and I've never seen one, but I have friends that who have, mm-hmm. usually those apparitions are from spirits that have been passed away maybe no more than 100 to 150 years. What happens after mm-hmm. that, they theorize, is that they become what's known around paranormal circles as shadow people. So what that means mm-hmm. is that the energy, like a battery, is getting low, and when you're energy mm-hmm. gets low, then you lose your definition. And I found that very interesting, because I've never heard of anyone having an apparition of somebody that was, say, back in maybe the 1700s or the 1600s.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another thing that was brought up in your book that I really enjoyed, was you know, the energy portion of it and how they interact mm-hmm. and all that was very interesting. Have you ever been mm-hmm. on a, well, I already asked you about a paranormal investigation. Where do you go to write? Can you tell us, do you use an outline, or is it pretty much free flowing, such as letting your characters take hold of the story?
Well, I am very much a planner. I brainstorm and plot. But I still do feel like my characters draw the story, because even as I'm brainstorming and plotting, you know, I'm creating the story as I do that. Like, I think there's some misconception for people who aren't plotters who find it stifling to have an outline or a plot. And I'm like, I'm still creating the story. I'm just doing it in an outline format instead of just, you know, 50,000 words and realizing, oh, crap, this isn't going to work, and having to go back. You know, I have it kind of, I know where I'm going. So I very much am a planner. The brainstorming, plotting part of writing is my favorite part of the whole thing. I just love doing it. I actually was working on plotting. We had a hurricane day the other day, and I took that day off to work on plotting out and brainstorming book 3 of the trilogy, which I hope will be out next July. So I always like to know where I'm going and be able to plan for that without having to. I feel like it helps me avoid writer's block, because I kind of feel like if I had to commit to this is actually where my story is going, I would freeze, you know. But when I'm brainstorming, I can write down anything I want. It doesn't matter how ridiculous it is. And then I don't have to ever see it again. But, you know, you brainstorm until you find that little nugget that makes your brain go, yes,
right.
This is where I want the story to go, you know. And so, yeah, so I love to brainstorm and plot and just kind of, I'll have an 8 or 9 page long brainstorm before I ever sit down to start actually putting the scenes together.
We are talking to Nina DeBoort. She's the author of Ghost Agents. And if you'd like to call in, if you're listening live again, you can call in at 914-219-0868. That's area code 914-219-0868. Anita, we did mention at the top of the show about you having other books published, and this isn't your first. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about your first book?
My first book was published in 2014. It's called Project Loxus. I've gotten a lot of feedback about the name is hard to pronounce. and that was really more of kind of a personal project, but it was like I told you, I've always wanted to be a writer, but I hadn't uh-huh. ever finished anything. And so I just committed about 2012, I think it was, I committed I'm going to finish a novel. And so I sat down and, you know, I would come home every night after work and I would work for a couple of hours on it and got it done, got it published, and then kind of didn't do anything with it. And then, you know, went back to teaching, and I had taken a year off to write. And so then I went back to teaching, and, you know, you get busy again and life kind of piles up on you. So I'm kind of circling back around now, 7 years later, to get serious again about doing
right.
it. But yeah, so Project Loxus, it's not paranormal. It's more of a speculative fiction. A mysterious fog spreads over the whole globe and wipes out 90% of the world's population. And
wow.
then my characters start to learn the truth about the fog. And of course, there's a government conspiracy involved. You know, it's always the government, right? So that it was fun. That was fun too. I learned a lot of stuff and made a lot of mistakes that I'm hoping I avoided with ghost agents because I made them back then. But
yeah, go ahead.
I just said that's the book, Project Loxus.
Oh, okay. In regards to that, with as far as editing, do you have an editor that you work with?
I did work with, I have several friends who, that's their English teachers, so that's their wheelhouse. And so my beta readers, some of my beta readers are English teachers. And one of them does work as an editor in her real job as well. But then with ghost agents, I did use an editor through Readzy. I found an editor through Readzy.
Yes.
And had a professional editor give it one look, you know, probably, I think it was July, beginning of July when I had that done, just to make sure that, you know, we all caught the mistakes and any sort of overarching storyline issues. And there were several things that she pointed out. Like one thing she pointed out was that I used the word just like 378 times, which nobody noticed it, right? Because it's not incorrect. But that's how I talk. And here in the South, I think we use just a lot. And so she was like, maybe bring it down to under 200. And so, you know, it was helpful things like that that I got to go. Everything she said strengthened the novel, everything that I went back
and found. So you were very satisfied with Readzy's editor, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm, yes.
Good.
Yeah. I definitely plan to use another editor for the next book two.
Uh-huh. In creating the characters for ghost agents, do you use traits from actual people like friends and relatives? That could be a lot of fun, by the way.
I try not to too much. I actually kind of think more about what actors and actresses could I imagine playing the role, you know, rather than my actual family members or friends. Sometimes the names, I'll have a friend who'll say, you know, name a character after me, and so I'll name the character, but that doesn't mean the character is anything like them, really. But as far as the character traits go, like, I really tend to think more about actors and actresses who might play it in a movie. I guess maybe that's wishful thinking. Hoping I'll get a film deal one day.
What made you decide to have Claire work in a candy store?
Well, down in Galveston, there is an actual candy store on the Strand. It's called La King's. And every time we go to Galveston, we have to stop at La King's and they have chocolate covered everything and ice cream. And they do have a taffy pulling demonstration. And so when I got the idea for ghost agents, I was actually down there fixing to do a ghost tour. And we had stopped at La King's. And I just had this idea of, wouldn't it be fun, you know, if my secret agent was out in the open, but not really, you know. So she worked there because, like, tons of tourists, even in the off-season, there's tons of tourists in La King's all the time. So that would be the perfect opportunity for my character to promote the history of the island and the ghost tours and the hauntedness of the island. So it's actually modeled after an actual candy store down there in Galveston that is very popular and very famous.
No pun intended, but I think
with those of us that are nearby.
No pun intended, but I think it added a lot of flavor to your story.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that that setting. It was nice.
Mm-hmm.
Who is your, if you were to pick in your book, who is your favorite character in Ghost Agents?
Well, I think, do you mean human or projection or of the two?
whoever.
Well, I think my favorite character is Miss Betty, because, I mean, she is one of the ghosts of Ashton Villa. She's like the ghost of Ashton Villa. And
yeah.
And everything that I wrote about her is historically what's understood about her, that she was a Texas princess. The story that she never married because every time a man would come and want to seek her hand, her dad would show them how much it cost to maintain her living. And no man stuck around. It's kind of the legend of Miss Betty. And I just thought that was hysterical that, you know, that she just was who she was. And she wanted to be taken seriously as a painter. So the paintings in Ashtonville, she did most of those. And she was just a saucy lady.
I loved Claire's ghostly roommates.
Mm-hmm.
Those were fun. They were a lot of fun.
Yeah, Thelma reminds me a lot of my students.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. What were you saying? Sorry.
Who are your favorite authors?
My favorite authors, I would have to say one of my favorites is James Rawlings. I love his Sigma Force series. I go back every now and then and reread them. He's a little bit more descriptive than I am, but I do love that. Just if you hadn't asked me, I could have told you. I just totally blanked out on the man who wrote the Scythe series. It's they're young adult books.
Uh-huh.
I can't think of it. There's a trilogy called Scythe, and he's very descriptive, but not overly descriptive. And I really admire the way he can it doesn't get bogged down in the description, because I think sometimes authors get too wordy, they get too in love with their own language. And he does, and he gives you descriptives. It's very vivid, but it's very concise as well. And so I will think of his name before just an Uber appointment.
What's easier for you, to write a narrative or do the dialogue?
The dialogue, I love the dialogue because I used to struggle with dialogue, but then I did an online course that basically had you write an entire story without any dialogue tags whatsoever. And that was a real challenge. But ever since then, I've found that I handle dialogue tags better, I think, because I had to get rid of them. And so, you know, we don't always have to say he said. We don't always have to say she said. We don't always have to say he said as he picked up his coffee and took a drink. You know, we can think of more creative and descriptive ways of saying what they did and how. So I prefer writing dialogue. I feel like when we get to the narrative and the exposition, I feel like I should be more descriptive and more wordy. You know, I feel the pressure for that. Whereas with the dialogue, it can be more concise. I like that.
While in the process of writing your first book, did you share it with anybody? And how did that make you feel after they read it?
I always have had beta readers, and I always, of course, make sure that it's people that you trust, whose opinions you trust. And I always try to pick, or I have picked in the past, people who love reading, you know, who have a good grasp of the English language, and then just people who just like reading, you know. So you want the people who have a good idea of how story works, but also the language, how the language should work. And I've gotten positive feedback. And I feel like when you tell the beta readers what you want them to be reading for, you know, like if you're honest with your beta readers and you don't want them just to say, oh, it's a good book, you know, tell me anything that made you go, what? Or anything that you noticed, you know, anything that jumps out at you, let me know, because I need to fix that. And so my beta readers have always been very good. I've always gotten good input. Again, just like with the editor, it always strengthens the writing. Because for Project Loxus, I had a friend of mine, one of my coworkers, who's the school nurse. She read it, and she's a mom, and she's a nurse. And so she had a perspective on the medical profession and her being a mom that I didn't have, because I'm neither. You know, so it was good to have that angle with somebody who could, you know, raise some questions or tell me, well, if it was my child, you know, I would do da-da-da-da-da. Oh, well, that makes sense, you know. And then I could alter some things from there, so... Yeah, the feedback has always been good. I like having beta readers because they're real people, you know, versus me just thinking what I think about it.
Right. What about the cover artwork? How does that work for you when you're looking around for cover artwork?
Well, Project Aloxus, I just kind of used the Kindle publishing thing. But with Ghost Agents, I really wanted it to be as professional as it could be, because I've read so many self-published books that were just unprofessional, and so I wanted this to be as professional as possible. So I do have a friend who is a professional graphic designer, and I asked her if she would be interested, and she said absolutely. And so so my friend Jennifer Hayden did my cover for me, and we talked just the other day, and she's ready and excited about doing book 2 and 3 as well. So hopefully we'll have that consistency of look across the trilogy. So
That's good. That's really good. Covers are very important, I think, when you're selling a book, especially when it's your first one. If you were granted a wish to meet up with a ghost, who would it be and why?
It would definitely be Jean Lafitte. He's in book 1. He's going to be in book 2 as well. Yeah, he's not going to be in book 3, but he's in book 1 and 2. He was
the pirate.
In
he was the pirate,
well.
Right?
He was the pirate, yes.
Yes.
And he very much, it's really fun that he spent time in Galveston, but he also spent time in New Orleans. So I have that in the book as well. So then in book two is set, it's going to split time in between Boston and New Orleans. So I'm able to bring Jean Lafitte back in book two. So that's fun for me. But yeah, I would definitely want to meet Jean Lafitte.
You know, you could do a lot of spinoffs. You could do a lot of spinoffs on a lot of the characters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the roommates there, the
yeah,
you know, Claire's roommates, and then of course
mm-hmm.
the pirate. And just mm-hmm. you know, I'm just thinking here is that would be maybe somewhere where you might want to go with.
Yeah.
So I think.
Well,
I
and
think
I've toyed with
good.
The idea. I've toyed with the idea once I get book two and three, you know, more underway, going back and doing a series of short stories like that, where you kind of a day in the life of Jean Lafitte or something, you know. Little short stories about some of the projections. I thought that would be kind of fun.
Is there anything you change about Ghost Agents?
At this point, no. it's still pretty new out there, so I feel like I sweated over it so much. I read a meme on a website that was like, they tell you to write the book you want to read because you're
yeah.
going to have to read your book 800 times, so you know, make sure you want to read it. And so I feel really good about Ghost Agents. I feel like I set up what I wanted to set up for book two and for the rest of the trilogy. I haven't gone back and reread Ghost Agents yet, so I might feel differently in a couple of months or a couple of years when I go back and reread it. But for right now, no, I don't think I would change anything at this point.
Good. How do you feel about the good and the bad reviews?
Well, I try not to look too much at the reviews for the very reason of, you know, the bad ones are hurtful. I don't think I've gotten any bad ones for Ghost Agents yet. I haven't, because I haven't looked in a while on Amazon.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I try to take who posted it. Is it somebody who loved me? Is it somebody who doesn't love me?
Right.
You know, what can I really do about it or not? I do know that there was one I saw on Amazon that I really wish I could respond to because they gave me 4 stars, which is fine. But then she said that Grant's brother's name changes halfway through the book from Luke to Keith. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. Keith is the fourth ghost hunter. You know, Luke is the brother, and then you have Drew, and then you have Spencer. But there's no way for me to respond to that. But I'm like, you know, who's really going to not buy my book because of that one bad review,
right?
You know, or
right.
that one comment, you know. I can't imagine there's people across America that will come across that one line and be like, well, I'm not buying it. You know, so I just kind of take it with a grain of salt. Not everyone's gonna like everything, so
right.
One
of the things that happens on Amazon is you want to look and make sure that it's a verified purchase. Make sure that they actually bought the book, because a lot of people will buy, well, they'll make comments about a book that they've never read, or they've read first couple of pages, and they decide that your book's a 1 star. That's just not professional.
Yeah.
I don't think for somebody to do that to an author who's you know, getting started like yourself. I think it's I don't think it does any justice to anyone by doing that at all. So that's why I asked the authors how they feel about the reviews, because some of them love reading all of them, and then some of them don't read any of them, and then some pick and choose, and that's just the way it goes. And I think too, the other thing about reviews is you want to have a lot of reviews, not so much that you want good quality reviews, but it's the number of reviews that matter in maybe an agent or a publisher picking you up in the future. So it has a lot to do more with quantity than the actual quality. Something that I found in the last couple of years after talking to several people in the industry. So that's just something for you to kind of think about as you go forward. And so you said you're working on another book, right? In the series. And that's number.
Yes. I'm expecting it to be a trilogy. So I would like book two to come out at the end of December. That's my goal, is to have end of December for book two. And then book three of the trilogy by the end of next July. but July 2022. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting close to the end of the show here, and I would like to know if you got any parting words that you'd like to share. You know, anybody you'd like to thank that you didn't?
Well, I mean, I think I thanked everybody, but I'd like to thank them again. So, of course, you know, my mom, my dad passed away in 2006, but he also enjoyed writing. And so I kind of feel like, you know, my parents supported me my whole life and basically everything I did. And so I kind of feel like me becoming a writer is sort of a dream of my dad's as well. So by me fulfilling my dream, you know, in a way, he's kind of fulfilling his as well through me. So, of course, I appreciate my parents always supporting me my whole life. My roommate, Ann, she's been roommates for many, many years, and she's like a sister. And so I jokingly say she's like a sister with all the benefits of being a sister, with all the baggage of actually being a sister. And so she's always very supportive, and I get to bounce ideas off of her, and I tell her what I'm thinking and where I'm going. And she's always a beta reader for me, so and she's a librarian, so books are very much her thing. Yeah, and my writing buddy, Georgia Ward, is also, she writes under the name Georgia Tribble, but she and I, you know, keep each other accountable with our writing, and we're both kind of trying to make it happen while we work other jobs as well. So it's good to have that kind of support from people who will read your stuff and be honest, but also who love you and won't hurt you. but to be honest and help you get better. So, yeah, I've just been blessed in my life with people that I can depend on who support me. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's still very blessed. Good. You mentioned earlier about, you know, kind of looking at your characters as who you would like for them to be played by. Who would you like Claire to be played by if this were a movie?
Well, you know, I waffle back and forth because in my story, Claire's in her 30s, but, you know, I'm a huge fan of Kate Winslet, even though I know Kate Winslet is British, not American. So I would love for Kate Winslet to play any of my lead characters in the story. But I also feel like I don't really know that many, like, actresses in their 30s anymore. I kind of feel like my age gets skewed the older I get. I don't really know their ages. But I think Anne Hathaway could also do a good job. And Claire get a little bit of the snark and the independence, you know, but the strength that I hope that Claire's strength comes out. I really hope that she's going to, as the character, as the story progresses, especially into the next two books, I very much want her to be, I don't want her to be one of those characters, one of those female characters that needs to be rescued all the time. You know, she's the one who kind of does the rescuing, actually. In my stories. And so, you know, she just gets stronger with every book, both physically, you know, as far as her powers or her abilities, with the energy, and just as a person as well. So, yeah, I think that either Anne Hathaway or Kate Winslet could do a good job portraying that strength.
That would be interesting to see. Maybe someday that will happen. So we'll have to look out for that, Nita. You just keep plugging away at the typewriter there. Typewriter. Who uses a typewriter nowadays? You know, it's a computer that we all work on, right? So anyways, I would like, before we go, just tell everybody more about where they can find you out there. I don't know why I keep asking that question, because everybody knows now social media.
Yeah.
But some people like to direct certain people to certain areas of the internet. So go ahead, tell us where we can find you.
Well, I do have a website. I'm not super techy, so I struggle to update it, but I do have a website with links and things. But I primarily do Facebook. I have an Facebook author page. I do have a Facebook or a Twitter author account as well, but I don't really tweet. But yeah, Facebook author page is really the prime place where I put things out there about, you know, upcoming events and what's coming out next and everything like that.
Very good. Well,
so Nita DeBoard.
It's been a pleasure, Nita, to have you on. And I'm going to look forward to reading the rest of the series. I'm happy to hear that you're going to continue the series. And I'm going to listen to the pirate. I can't wait to interact with him again. He was a lot of fun.
Awesome.
So Thank you so much. And see, it wasn't.
Well, thank
you. Nervous. You weren't nervous at all.
Well, thank you. I like to talk, so, you know, my nerves, I can still talk about anything at any time, even when I'm nervous, but, you know. But thank you so much for having me on. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
You have a good night.
Right. You too, Tom. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, there goes Nita, and now we're on to the final chapter, final thoughts and intro to the next show, Monday, October 4th. 2021 at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Barbara Kamik will be here. This is an amazing lady who I am honored to call friend. Actually, she's more than that to me. She's my girlfriend's mother, and I've come to love her dearly. Barbara is a writer of weekly inspirations, but she is quick to point out that the words that she writes doesn't come from her. They come from God through her. Through these weekly inspirations from God, she has compiled a book, which we will talk about, in another book she wrote about a cat she took care of. Her name was Misty, and that's also the name of the book, and it was written through the perspective of Misty and her life spent here on Earth and beyond. I hope you will join us 2 weeks from today when we sit down with Barbara Kamik. Until then, see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers alike to keep that pen and those eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make